Welcome to the Red-Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thank you for spending some time with me today, studying artifacts our ancient Near Eastern ancestors left behind, and considering if those items just might change how we read or read into scripture. So last week, we talked about King Manasseh, and in the book of 2 Kings, he is considered to be the absolute worst king that the Southern Kingdom ever had. Among his sins, he sanctioned and encouraged the worship of pagan gods throughout his country. He forced his own son to, quote, go through the fire, which we don't fully understand exactly what that meant, but it seems to be an indication of some sort of human sacrifice. He is accused of murdering innocent Jerusalemites for no apparent reason, possibly for political reasons, but we don't know why he did that. He also is accused of practicing all kinds of magic, necromancy, divination, everything that you could think of, it seems like is written about in 2 Kings. Well, because of all of these actions, God, through his prophets, declared that God would thoroughly cleanse Jerusalem. And he would do it in the way that one cleans a dirty bowl from the inside out, and that he would relinquish what is left to the possession of their adversaries. We're really going to get into that adversaries portion in the last two episodes of the season. But just to wrap up with Manasseh, because his reign is so long and he was considered so evil, in Chronicles, we end up with a redemption story that seems to try to reconcile the length of his reign with his wickedness by explaining that he actually had a redemption story of his own toward the end of his life, that he actually tried to turn things around in the end. And according to the chronicler, that is based on a document, an older historical document that has been lost right now. And it's one of those many documents that I hope archaeologists will one day be able to find. It would be great if we had more historical records of the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom of the United Kingdom of Israel, all of those things. Well, so after his death, he is followed as king of the Southern Kingdom by his son Amon, and he only rules for 2 years. We are told that his servants murdered him in the palace. And in the cases where there are servants to a king, don't think that means that these were slaves. It's more likely that what is meant by servants there is courtiers or maybe some of his advisors. It's actually indicating that it was people who were in power within his government who actually overthrew him. So his people then murdered the people who murdered Amon. And after all of that, we have an 8-year-old come to the throne of the Southern Kingdom, and his name is Josiah, undoubtedly one of the most famous kings of Israel and one of the most honored and most favorably remembered by scriptures and by those of us reading scriptures today. Well, so Chronicles tells us that Josiah began to follow God at the age of 16. So he had technically been on the throne probably as part of some sort of regency, because there aren't a lot of 8-year-olds who can rule a country. But at the age of 16, he is autonomous enough that he has an encounter with God. And he begins to clear out all of the illegal cultic practices in that country that had been encouraged by his father and his grandfather and the wicked kings prior to him. All of this work begins by the age of 20 for him. So Josiah goes on to rule for 31 years, and his first significant action for the country, which is mentioned in both Kings and in Chronicles, that happens when he's 26 years old. He orchestrates the renovation and the restoration of the temple. And there it says that the workers who were doing all of this work on the building found something that is called the Book of the Law. This would have been around 628 BCE. And as an archaeologist, as someone who is a historian, as someone who studied and loves all these things, I'm at pains to point out that 628 is hundreds of years before actually books were invented. So we have two questions here. The Book of the Law, what was it physically? And then actually, what was contained in this document that was found inside of the temple? And also, why did it go unread for so many generations in Jerusalem? We don't really get an answer to that last question. But what becomes important is the fact that it is found and the changes that are made as a result of it. Well, to start with, any book that is referred to from the 7th century or earlier, even a few hundred years later than that, would not have actually been a book as we think of it today. It would have been a scroll. So during the 7th century, during the time that all of this is taking place, scribes would mix their own ink. They would either be black or red in the Levant. That is what we find there. And then they would take that ink that they made out of ash, and they would use a stylus, just basically a piece of wood that had been sharpened down. And then they would write on thick, heavy leather scrolls. So scrolls at the time were really great in one way, because as they were creating the scrolls, it could just never end. Basically, tanners would take leather, they would scrape them down, they would cut them into reasonable sizes, and then scribes would begin to write. And when they got to the end of a section of the leather, they would take another section of leather and then simply stitch the two together. And then they would continue writing on that piece that had just been added there. They would write in columns typically. And so the scroll would just be added to and added to and added to until all of the content that needed to go into it was completed. If you take a look at some of the images of Dead Sea Scrolls, some of the scrolls, like the Great Isaiah Scroll, some of them, they're absolutely huge because there's so much information that had to go in there. So that's one kind of nice thing about leather scrolls is they're infinite. You know, as long as you could carry a scroll, you could make it as big and long and heavy as you really wanted it to be. What makes it great is also what sort of made it challenging. When a scroll is made of heavy, heavy leather, it gets heavy and it is not very, very portable. Well, so over time, the media changed a little bit, and there were the developments of other types of materials that could be written on. And you have leather becoming more and more refined, first into parchment, which is simply a very fine leather. It's more pliable, it's thinner, and then all the way to vellum, which even makes parchment look like it's big and fat and heavy. Well, parchment and vellum would work the same way that the heavier leathers did, and they would be stitched together into scrolls. And this went on for hundreds and hundreds of years. Considering all of the media that we have found that has a scripture written on it, everything from scrolls to some of the fragments that we have discovered, even just in this season of the podcast, thinking about the Tel Dan Stela that has a mention on it there, all sorts of, they're just fragments all over in the Near East that have information written on them. Well, when you put all of those bits and pieces together, arguably, and long arguments go on about this, what is one of the things that is accepted as being one of the oldest versions of scripture is actually included on a tiny silver scroll. And this tiny silver scroll has written on it the words that roughly correspond to Numbers 6, 24 through 26, which states, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." Also, someone took silver, which would have been very, very expensive at the time, had these words written on there almost microscopically. The scroll was rolled up tight and placed on a necklace, and someone would have worn it around almost as an amulet, as a reminder of, you know, something of keeping God and keeping scripture close to their heart at the time. This particular piece is from around 700 BCE, so slightly older than what we are talking about with King Josiah at the time. But it's in the ballpark, especially archaeologically speaking. 700 going down to 628, those are in the same ballpark, both within the Iron Age. As materials for scrolls and materials for writing evolved, you got your vellum and you had your vellum and your parchment and your leather. But also down in Egypt, we see the development of papyrus. And papyrus was something that was almost uniquely Egyptian at the time because papyrus reeds grow so well there. And so they would pick the wild weeds, pound them out, spread out the pith, and take the different branches of the papyrus reed, lay them at crossways to each other, pound it flat, and then those pieces of papyrus could be treated in the same way that parchment and leather and vellum were, and that they could be stitched together into a scroll. As different materials for scroll production were developed, as they advanced slowly over time, there came a point where someone said, maybe there's a better way to put all this together. And so during the Roman Empire, we have the entrance of what are the first books, and they are called, an individual one would be called a codex. The plural of that is codices. So codices were invented during the Roman Empire, and they would take those same raw materials that once would be stitched edge to edge to edge, and instead they took the pieces, stacked them on top of each other, and then seamed them all on one side. So once the codex is developed, the scroll rather rapidly starts to go away, because the codex is just, it's easier to carry around than a big old scroll. It's easier to thumb through and find exactly the area that you're looking for. It's a faster medium to create. There are lots of things that are positive about a physical book, if you will. So all of that is to say, when you read about the Book of the Law being discovered, realize what it's actually talking about at that time is a scroll of the law. That would be a better description of what is found there. Well, so what was actually contained in this scroll of the law, you might ask? and that is, we don't know. Scripture doesn't actually tell us. It's another one of those books that I hope gets found one day. But what most archaeologists, scholars, theologians, historians, pastors, what most people will tell you is that it was likely an early version of the Book of Deuteronomy or something like that. It included a lot of, obviously, the cultic rules, but also the rules for daily living that had been given by God to Moses. But it wasn't called Deuteronomy yet. Those names hadn't been laid down for any of these kinds of books. But it seems, based on the way the story is told, and then according to people, linguists who have studied these kinds of things far more in depth than I have, there's a general consensus that it was probably some version of the Book of Deuteronomy. Again, I hope we can actually find it one day. Following the discovery of the Book of the Law, and following the repairs to the temple and Josiah's instructions to destroy all of the cultic sites that are still remaining in Judah, Josiah and all of the people celebrate a massive Passover feast. And as we saw with Hezekiah, Kings once again uses more words, more ink, more leather, if you will, to describe the good religious reforms that Josiah made than it spends on any of his political challenges or anything else that was happening historically at the time. The scripture is very, very concerned about his religious purity and him helping the country to follow God. Well, because he followed God and because he restored proper worship, we get a message in scripture from the prophetess Huldah, and she states that because he was so good and because of the reforms that he made, Josiah himself would not see the fall of Jerusalem, but the fall of Jerusalem was still coming. So last week, I mentioned that there was civil war brewing within the Neo-Assyrian Empire. Around 650, Samishmaucan was the king of Babylon, which was a city at the time, but it was already really starting to influence and be influenced by the regions that were around it. They were beginning to revolt against his younger brother, but the emperor of the entire Neo-Assyrian Empire, Ashurbanipal. So you have this struggle between those two. Ashurbanipal ends up putting down the rebellion by the Babylonians at that time, but the unrest continued. Well, so this week, while we're talking about Josiah, we're about 20 years farther down the road in history. Josiah, yes, he is the king. He's on the king of the southern kingdom of Israel. And Neo-Assyrian power over the course of this 20 years has really continued to wane. So part of the reason we know a lot about the Neo-Assyrian Empire and the Neo-Babylonian Empire that would follow it is because of a collection of tablets that is called the Babylonian Chronicle. One of those tablets is called the Chronicle Concerning the Early Years of Nabopolassar. That's another one of those descriptive but not super creative titles that an archaeologist gave this particular tablet. Well, in it, it says that in 627, there's a new generation of leaders beyond these two warring brothers. It's the next generation, new leadership in Babylon and Assyria. They are still warring with each other. They are still brokering peace back and forth. But it is clear that Babylonia is on the rise and Assyria is in the decline. And so what Assyria ends up doing is going to their old vassal state, Egypt. And you'll remember from a previous episode that the king on the throne in Egypt at the time was actually put there by the Neo-Assyrians. And so they are very much allies of the waning Neo-Assyrian Empire. So by 616, Nabopolassar, who is over Babylonia, he is controlling not just the city of Babylon, but all of the region around it. Egypt is now actively helping Assyria, what is left of the Neo-Assyrian Empire. In 612, the Medes and the Babylonians, they get together, they go to Nineveh, they take Nineveh, they push the king, the last king, the final king of the Neo-Assyrian Empire, they push him to a city called Haran. And then in 610, Haran also falls to the Babylonians. It is at this point that we talk about the new Neo-Babylonian Empire. That's where it happens. Well, so the year after this, Pharaoh Necho II, who is down in Egypt, he is still trying to help whatever little bits and pieces of the Assyrian Empire are remaining. And so in 609, Necho ends up marching north. And in order to get to Assyria, there's really no way around it. He has to go through the southern kingdom. His goal is to get to the Euphrates River. And in his way is the city of Megiddo. So when Josiah hears that the Pharaoh Necho is coming up through his country, Josiah ends up riding to Megiddo and meeting him there. Josiah there ends up getting killed by an arrow. And this story is told to us in Chronicles. Now, Megiddo, it is a really popular place to attack. In fact, in all of recorded history, the very first battle to have ever happened that got written about actually happened in Megiddo. And a lot of that is because the location of the city is practically perfect. It's about a 15-acre site, and it sits 60 meters above the surrounding valley. And it is also on a very important trade route that is between Egypt and Anatolia and Mesopotamia. And if you ever get the chance to go and visit it, which I always recommend that people do if they can, when you're standing on top of the city, it is so easy to understand like why it was a good place for Solomon to come and fortify. It is so far above, you can see an invading army or a group of merchants or shepherds or whoever is outside the city gates. You can see them coming from many, many, many miles away because of the way that it is organized. Well, so today, the area that surrounds that tell is mostly farmland. But in antiquity, it would have been constantly used as campsites for some of these invading armies coming through. And then, of course, as pasture land for the animals that maybe lived within the city, slept there at night, but then went outside the gates of the city to graze during the day. So we can thank a lot of the nations surrounding Israel for giving us a really great timeline of what happened at Megiddo. Megiddo is actually the only city in ancient Israel that appears in all of its neighbors' war annals. The first battle that was fought there was done by Pharaoh Thutmose III. He fought a Canaanite coalition there in 1468 BCE, and after a seven-month-long siege, he took the city for Egypt. Then later in 1220, so that's about a little more than 200 years later, Pharaoh Merneptah, he also tried to take it. And then Pharaoh Shoshank I, who many people believe that's who the Bible is referring to when the Bible states Shishak, he attacked it in 924. Then, of course, as we have discussed in this podcast, the Assyrian king, Tiglath-Pileser III, He captured Megiddo, and he actually made it a capital of one of the districts that included Galilee in that area. So it was sort of a district capital for the Neo-Assyrian Empire at the time. And then in 609, when Pharaoh Necho comes up, he ends up meeting Josiah there. He actually ends up, instead of helping Assyria, he actually takes Megiddo back for Egypt, and it becomes a part of Egypt again after his campaign there. Speaking just as an archaeological site, Megiddo has been really well excavated. In fact, it's probably one of the best excavated sites in Israel. The work began there in 1925, and with the exception of times of war, it has pretty much continued for almost 100 years now. Work is still being done there today. I believe Israel Finkelstein is in charge of it now. And because of that, we see great destruction layers. It's a wonderful site for helping us come up with dates, not just for the Bible, but for battles across antiquity. It's a really important site to the field of archaeology. Well, so after the Babylonian and Persian empires end up coming in, that's what we're going to be talking about in the last two episodes, when they come in and they take over, it's at that point that the city of Megiddo, or I should say the tell of Megiddo, ends up being abandoned. And Megiddo is basically deserted. And so to hear it mentioned again, you have to go to the very end of Scripture. For Christians, that would be in the book of Revelation. And John mentions it. When he is recording the revelation that he received from Jesus Christ, he inks what is a Greek transliteration of the Hebrew word. The Hebrew of Mountain of Megiddo is Har. Har is mountain. Har, Megiddo. And so he transliterates that into Greek. And English translators, instead of translating it, they actually put the transliteration of that Greek transliteration of the Hebrew into our Bibles. And so that's how we end up with this word Armageddon. It is just the way the language evolved from Hebrew into Greek and then into our English translations now. So when you see Armageddon in there, it's nice to remember the history of this site, that Tel Megiddo is itself just a place of war. First war in recorded history. And according to the Bible, it will be the last war in recorded history that will happen there as well. One funny little story I always like to tell is in 1917, when almost 10 years prior to the excavations actually beginning there, there was a battle at Megiddo, and a British general named Edmund Allenby, he went and he fought the Ottoman Turks at Megiddo, and he won. And there are these newspapers that you can find that were published in London at the time, right at the end of the First World War, and they call him Lord Allenby of Megiddo. And I have dug and I looked to see if there are any other writings or anything like that that he did, any reflections that he wrote on this time. And I can only wonder if he somehow thought that this battle would be tied into what John predicted. If he thought that this would hasten the return of Jesus. But I've not been able to find any sources from 100 years ago that, you know, say what his reflections were on getting that title, Lord Allenby of Megiddo. That's just sort of a funny little historical story to add in there. As much as we know about Megiddo, sadly, the Bible tells us very little about their confrontation. And at the very core, my question is, why did Josiah go up there to begin with? We don't know. People have theorized about it. Maybe he saw himself as being on some sort of a diplomatic mission. Maybe from one king to another, he was going up there to meet Pharaoh Necho, to have a conversation about the Assyrians or about the Assyrian-Babylonian situation. That's one idea. Maybe he thought his country was being invaded and he was going up there to protect his people and to protect, you know, their brothers and sisters that were in this northern area at the time. Maybe he even had some sort of alliance with the Babylonians at the time, and he was going up there as their proxy in the same way that Necho was trying to go up and support the Assyrians. We only have theories because there is no reason given anywhere, not in Scripture and not in any of the foreign sources that we have. again, hopefully one day we'll get some of these books of the Chronicles of the Kings of Judah and maybe we'll get some more details in there. But for now, we can only wonder as to why Josiah made that particular choice. What we do know is the material result. Of course, Josiah ends up getting killed by an arrow when he is at Megiddo, but also Pharaoh Necho is able to take the city of Megiddo. It becomes part of Egypt. So at that time, because of the death of the king, because of Necho being up there, the southern kingdom then becomes a vassal state of Egypt. And within 3 months, Necho, he takes Josiah's son and heir, he imprisons him, he deports them, he massively taxes the people. This is what all emperors seem to do time and again. I feel like I say this every single week. He does all these things, but then he takes a man named Jehoiakim and he puts him on Jerusalem's throne as a puppet king, which is maybe a little bit ironic considering that Necho himself is a descendant of a puppet king who was put on Egypt's throne by Assyria. So we just see these old patterns and these old habits recycling themselves. But here it is impacting the southern kingdom of Judah. So we have Jehoiakim. He is on the throne. He ends up ruling for 11 years. But during this time, his loyalties actually end up shifting from Egypt to Babylonia. Because in 605, there is an extremely famous historical battle that happens. It's called the Battle of Carchemish. And Pharaoh Necho and the now famous or infamous Neo-Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, they meet and Egypt loses, and he loses badly. Necho's forces, all of Egypt, they end up getting pushed all the way back to the African continent. So they lose Megiddo, they lose everything else that they had captured in the area. They're pushed there, and all of their possessions that are in the Levant end up going to Babylonia. So at this point, as we end today, Jerusalem still hasn't fallen to Babylonia, but basically everything around it has. Jerusalem is the last man standing. Join me next week when we meet the final king of the southern kingdom, Zedekiah, and it falls to Nebuchadnezzar and the Neo-Babylonians. The Red-Haired Archaeologist podcast is researched, written, and recorded by me, Amanda Hope Haley. It is edited by Tanya Yerimgiv. New episodes are released each Thursday. To interact with me and other listeners, make sure you click the follow button on the Red-Haired Archaeologist pages on Facebook and Instagram, and subscribe to my channel on YouTube. Then check out my website at redhairedarchaeologist.com, where you can subscribe to my monthly email, order signed copies of all my books, and schedule me to come speak in your town.